Morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. For the sake of the audio record, today's date is January 20, 2021. This panel of the court today has five cases on its calendar, three of which will be submitted with oral argument by Zoom, and two of which will be submitted without oral argument, solely on the briefs. The first case set for oral argument is number A20-0707, is Ronnie versus Sidwani. Counsel for both parties are familiar with our usual rules, and if you maintain the right view settings, you'll be able to see the time clock with your time remaining. Counsel for appellant may identify yourself and begin.
Good morning, Your Honor. I may please the court. Brian L. Sobel for the appellant, Sonal Sidwani. Your Honors, this matter involves primarily a legal issue and whether, based on the facts of this record, the lower court erred and abused its discretion in failing to properly apply MnSTAT Section 518.552 Subdivision 3 that mandates when there is a question as to an obligee's future ability to become fully self-supporting based on the marital standard of living, the court shall award permanent spousal maintenance. This particular subdivision is one of the few in Chapter 518 that is absolute in direction. Other portions of the statute clearly vest the trial court with significant discretion and uses verbs such as may, or when it uses the verb shall, it's in the context of a sentence that's not unambiguous. In this particular subdivision, the legislature has left no ambiguity. Where there is some uncertainty as to the necessity of a permanent award, the court shall award permanent spousal maintenance.
Can I ask you this? I know you're saying this is a matter of law, but obviously the law is contingent upon a finding that there is some uncertainty. Do you think the judge's orders and the findings of the fact in the judge's order finds that uncertainty? Are you contesting those findings?
We're saying, Your Honor, that based on the totality of the record, it's against logic. It was against logic and the facts on the record for this court to find that there was a question, or that the court really didn't find a question. It found that at the time of trial, she was disabled, and that should be the end of the question. But this court felt that it wanted to take another look in 2 years, and that maybe she could rehabilitate a little more and we should look again in 2 years. So in other words, the court essentially judicially modified the statute. It added another step that even though there's a question at the time of trial as to her ability to become self-supporting, because maybe she might get a little better, we should look again. And that's not what the statute says. The statute says at the time of trial, if there's uncertainty, the court shall. And that, Your Honor, is the error that we believe is present. Wife unquestionably suffered a major medical episode in 2017. She suffered permanent brain damage. There was no question as to that.
Go ahead, Judge Slater.
I wanted to follow up, Mr. Sobel, with Judge Hooten's question a bit, and that's the phrase reserved. I believe we have case law that, for instance, in the area of child support, if it's reserved and in the future child support is considered an establishment because it's never been set. My question is one way as a matter of law to look at this is the court simply, and it did make findings and conclusions, there was not enough evidence that it hasn't been established. And so in effect, you have a 2-year temporary spousal maintenance, similar to a temporary order prior to trial. Do you see that distinction? And do we look at it differently when it's reserved versus if that had been silent?
I think the issue is, again, Your Honor, the construction of the legislative intent in the language they chose in how they drafted this particular statute. This was not a statute where they gave the court discretion to reserve the issue if there was uncertainty. They were clear. If there's uncertainty at the time of trial, no reservation, the court shall award permanent maintenance, leaving it open for further review in the future. So that right's still open. The respondent at some future date, if he feels that she's recovered, can make a motion and move to modify. But that puts the burden of proof on the respondent. What the judge has done in this case, what the referee has done in this case, he's shifted the burden of proof. He's put it back on the appellant to come back in 2 years and again, reprove her case. And that's not what the statute says. We go to trial And one of the fundamental principles of Minnesota divorce law is that there's finality. You come to trial, you litigate an issue, and there's finality. We don't leave it open and say, we're going to have another trial in 2 years because there's a lot of money involved. And that underlying the opinion is what this referee said. There's a lot of money involved. I want to take another look. There's a lot of questions. There weren't a lot of questions. She had been deemed permanently disabled by Social Security. The court itself observed her physical disability in trial. We had multiple witnesses testifying that she had reached the limit of her physical recovery, that she it was a miracle she'd gotten as far as she could, but she wasn't going to recover any further physical. It would be highly unlikely. Those were the that was the language used by the physical therapist. Highly unlikely there would be any further physical improvement. The psychologist that testified that the team working with her, the neurologist, the physical therapist, and he all believed aspiration at best, at some point in the future, maybe she could hold a low-level job in Mumbai. So clearly there was a question. There was uncertainty at the time of trial as to her ability to become self-supporting. She met her burden of proof. And under the statute, the court was required as a matter of law to award permanent spousal maintenance, and it didn't. So it's one of those rare cases where I feel so strongly that the facts compel this conclusion that I just don't see how we can reach another conclusion. To rule otherwise essentially modifies the language of 518.552.
Can I ask you, with regard to the Social Security finding a disability, was that based on her physical injuries, her brain injury?
Right. If you look at Exhibit 15, that's the order in the trial Exhibit 15, and it was Judge Ailing. And as we discussed in our brief, there were two issues before the court at that time. And that's, I think, what confused this court in this proceeding. There were two different issues. She had mental health issues prior to 2017. And that was her original claim, that she was severely depressed because of the death of her father, and she couldn't function as a physician. And she lost that part of her case. The court found that she did not meet the criteria of being disabled because of the mental health issue. However, because of the physical injury that her brain suffered in 2017, she was, under federal law, totally disabled. And that was the finding. And it was based on some of the same evidence that was submitted to the trial court in this matter, hypoxic encephalopathy, all of the physical problems that flowed from the brain damage. That qualified her for permanent disability status. That was her status at the time of trial. Although the court reserved issue for another hearing in a year, that hearing didn't take place. I'm assuming that the government decided to leave it, and she was still, under the federal law, totally disabled. So it was similar to some of the cases that I cited to the court in our brief, where
was there any testimony or any evidentiary support for an assertion that as a result of her physical injury, her brain injury, she would improve over time?
I believe that's why they reserved the issue. The Social Security Administration reserved the issue for further hearing, but that never happened. And again, in this particular case, the record, and we cite to the transcript in our brief, the physical therapist stated that it was a miracle. You rarely see victims of this type of brain injury recovering to the level that she had reached. But after 24 months, it was highly unlikely she was going to improve any further.
So, Mr. Expressed relative to her likelihood of getting better from the brain injury.
The record was it was unlikely she was going to get any better from the brain injury. The further goal of therapy was to maintain her where she was, to keep her from going backwards.
But the referee made a statement in the order that she has the potential of continuing her improvement. I'm looking at paragraph 71, page 14 of the addendum.
And that's what we argue is against logic and the facts on the record. There is nothing in this record that says that.
Before you go on, I mean, this goes back to Judge Hooten's first question, I think, that the determination that you're talking about as a matter of law is dependent upon certain factual predicates, right? And
right.
If there was a finding that this person will not improve, that's one thing. If there's a finding that the person will improve, that's a different thing. if there's a finding that the person might but might not improve, perhaps that's a different case. So, but the district court saw this as a case where she has the potential of continuing her improvement.
Right, I understand that, and what we're saying is that was an abuse of discretion. The record does not support that conclusion. When every medical expert and every medical record says she has reached the maximum physical recovery that's expected, then there's a question answer. Then that finding was an error. But regardless, even based on the referee's findings, at the time of trial, there was a question. We didn't know. Maybe she might get better. That was what he said. But maybe she wouldn't. There was uncertainty. So again, at the time of trial, when there's uncertainty, the legislature has mandated you shall award permanent maintenance. But as we discussed in our briefs, I think where the referee got confused was the difference between the testimony that respondent proffered as to her ability to get better emotionally versus her ability to get better physically. And that's, I think, where the court got confused. There was testimony from the one expert that the respondent submitted that he thought somehow that if she did vocational reintegration, she might do better emotionally. But he admitted, and we cite this in our reply brief, and I think in our brief in chief, he admitted that he didn't do a physical exam. He wasn't a neurologist. He couldn't opine as to her ability to improve physically. He was looking at her mental health. And those were that's where the two conflated issues got the court off track. If the court had just focused on the physical issue, which was the real issue, could she physically work, it would have seen that the testimony was absolute. She can't work right now. There was a question as to whether she could work in the future. And at best, maybe she could hold a low-level job. And even in a low-level job, no evidence that she could be self-supporting. So based on the totality of the record, there was uncertainty, and that mandated the award of permanent maintenance.
Can I ask you, in reading the statute, let's go back to the issue of a law. Does that mean that any time that anyone has an injury for which they're recovering, because as in most injuries, there may or may not be a likelihood of recovery or not, but there's always some uncertainty that in that case, the court has to order permanent special maintenance.
I guess I would turn to Dobrin, which says that every single case is different. You look at the facts of each case. If there's evidence in a case like you said, where there's a good possibility that someone might recover, maybe that might be an appropriate case where there was an uncertainty. But where there's the level of medical evidence that we had in this case, where there clearly was uncertainty, this was not a case where there was a strong likelihood of improvement. So I think Dobrin kind of controls that. It's a case-by-case basis. But under the facts of this case, clearly there was uncertainty.
So is it incumbent upon the judge to make a determination about whether there's uncertainty or not, or whether
The court has to make the finding. I think the court has to apply the 518.552 to make the appropriate findings under the statute. And one of the findings it must make is make a determination as to whether it should be temporary or permanent. And in terms of the request in this case for permanent maintenance based on her physical condition, the court had to make a finding as to whether there was uncertainty. And it didn't in this case. It said it was an open question, which I think, again, under the record was an error. I'd like to, if I could, just briefly address the other two issues that we raised in our brief. One related to the findings as to spousal maintenance. And I think that was a case where the record really doesn't explain why the court looked at a supporting budget that we prepared to bolster her primary budget, and he adjusted and worked off of that, and he ignored her primary budget. And that's where we allege there was an error. That's not a discretionary issue. The record doesn't explain why he worked off what was a supporting budget. Our exhibit 131, the expert report, was clearly a budget that was to support her primary budget, which was 121. But this referee worked primarily, exclusively, off of 131 and ignored the testimony that wasn't her primary budget, 121 was. So in doing that, the court understated her needs. We also discussed in our brief.
Excuse me, Mr. Sobel, doesn't 131 essentially account for the fact that she's living in India and plans to.
That was why we retained that expert, to try to give background to support the budget, that these are the certain costs that the court certainly couldn't opine to, because it was the cost of living in Mumbai. But her budget then had other discussions and other points to it that were separate from that supporting budget. So again, it was clear, I think, from the testimony that her main budget was 121, and the referee didn't have one finding about that budget, or why he just zeroed in on the supporting budget that we introduced testimony for. So I think that's the error. I think this court in reviewing a matter has to have a record to understand why a court made a decision. And we're suggesting in this case, there is no explanation as to why the referee missed the correct budget. So we think that mandates a reversal, at the very least, for the court to explain why it didn't look at her primary budget. We also talk about the math issue, that being that even if you accept his number, if you plug that into the cash flow schedules that we submitted, he's understated her needs by approximately, the maintenance amount should have been $4,604, not $3,870. He was off, I think, $1,100.
To be specific, I mean, is there a particular line item that was on 121 but not on 131, and therefore the referee missed it completely?
There were additional items. There were additional expenses. She, for example, I think furnishings. There was testimony that the budget for Mumbai was a semi-furnished apartment, which is kind of typical in Mumbai, but most people have to buy their own furnishings. She couldn't ship her furnishings. Eden Prairie was going to have to buy furniture. He missed that. That's just one example that jumps out at me. There were other mathematical errors too, in terms of the automobile that we discussed, that there simply was no way she could buy the type of automobile described in the testimony for $300 a month. I don't know why he arbitrarily knocked off $200, but that didn't work. Finally, Your Honor, in terms of the attorney's fees, I think based on the record, the court did err. I know the court has a lot of discretion in terms of awarding attorney's fees, but again, this court seemed, again, fixated on the fact that because the respondent's obligation could be large, he had carte blanche to litigate. I don't think that's the law. You have to litigate in good faith, and you have to raise good faith claims. And we spent a lot of time and a lot of money with the crazy theory that she didn't need maintenance at all, because her reasonable standard of living should be $2,500, because that's how a Mumbaian would live, in a middle-class Mumbaian would live. We spent a lot of time spinning our wheels over phantom assets and jewelry. And for all those reasons, I think, as we discussed in our brief, the court erred in failing to award some need-based, because she didn't have the ability to pay her fees and conduct-based fees. And my time is up.
Thank you, Mr. Sobel. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, you may identify yourself and begin.
Good morning, Your Honors. Gary Diebele here on behalf of respondent Dr. Ajay Israni. I'd like to start first, if I could, about a kind of a housekeeping motion that Mr. Sobel filed. He referenced this in his brief, his reply brief, and then on Martin Luther King Day on Monday, he filed a motion with the court asking that various portions of my brief be stricken, in particular places where I reference to prior orders of the court and prior affidavits and memoranda, all of which were submitted in the course of this proceeding, and which Mr. Sobel and his client responded to with their own affidavits and memoranda. I think that issue is really controlled by a clear appellate rule, which, interestingly enough, he cites in his motion, or in his brief, but he omits in the motion filed on Monday. It's Rule of Civil Appellate Procedure 110.01, which defines the appellate record to consist of, quote, documents filed in the trial court, and then goes on to talk about exhibits and testimony. So I'm absolutely, I don't know what the basis of this is, other than he doesn't like my clarifying some of the misrepresentations he made in his brief by reference to the record. But, you know, I clerked at the Court of Appeals 30 some years ago. We get the entire record from the trial court. We did as law clerks, you as judges review it. I don't know how we can argue that those documents are not part of the record. So I would simply ask that motion and that portion of that request in his brief be denied. Now I'll move on to the substance of the argument. I think the critical starting point goes back to Judge Hooten's initial question. What is the standard of review in this case? And I argued in my responsive brief that the entire case should be looked at with an abuse of discretion, clearly erroneous standard. While Mr. Sobel cites the statute, and nobody disputes that that has been a longstanding law, that when there is doubt as to whether the party can ever contribute to their own support, then there is that mandate. But if the issue comes down to when the party can become able to contribute to their support, that's an entirely different question. And I think that statute, part of the statute, has been interpreted several times. The most recent by this court in a published decision was that Myers case, which came out in 2009. And then I also referenced throughout that section of my brief, the unpublished Basting versus Makepence case, which came down in 2010, which is closer as a matter of fact to our case than the Myers case, but the principle is the same. And I think we have to start with this notion. Now, if we establish that that is the standard of review, then we really focus in, as is typical in a spousal maintenance case, as all the cases indicate, the trial court judge has significant discretion in assessing credibility and hearing the witnesses and determining what the findings should be and what the legal consequences should be. And I think we have to really focus on this particular issue on finding 72, which is found on page 14 of the appellant's addendum. And it says, no expert or party at trial was able to testify with certainty about Dr. Sidwani's future recovery, but the court will award temporary spousal maintenance to ensure that Dr. Sidwani has the time and ability to prioritize her health, both mentally and physically, so that she is able to return to the workforce in some capacity. And I think that last sentence is Referee Hutchison's indication that he feels she is going to be able to return in some capacity. Will she be a hospitalist doctor? No.
That's one of the main criticisms that have been leveled by Mr. Sobel is that you're conflating the mental health condition with her brain injury problem. I mean, is it correct that the Social Security basically found disability based on the brain injury? And if so, why are we talking so much about the mental health? And isn't your evidence basically directed to her mental health condition?
Your Honor, I strongly disagree with Mr. Sobel's characterization that either our case focused wrongly on mental health as opposed to physical, or that Referee Hutchison did the same thing. Mr. Sobel has kind of cherry-picked the things in the record, and he makes this grand statement that there is absolutely no dispute when you read this record that that Dr. Sidwani is permanently physically disabled. In fact, this case has always been about three issues. In fact, her own treating psychologist who testified at this trial indicated that there are three components to her situation. One is the physical, neurological, he called it organic. There clearly is that's been where she's had a lot of her difficulty. But he also opined, and this was our position throughout this trial, that there is a mental health component as well. You know, the record is replete. Dr. Sidwani's medical history goes way back, many years. I mean, she's battled depression. She's had several suicide attempts. She's had eating disorders. She struggled with depression for years. And, you know, one of the things that we did was when we started looking at the record and got involved in this, it became clear that we needed two experts to really dig into this. One was a neurologist, Dr. Desai from India, who reviewed the records and met with her, with Dr. Sullen, offered an opinion. And then we also hired Dr. Gratzer, who is a psychiatrist. And the reason we did that was because Dr. Desai, the neurologist, indicated that yes, she's making progress physically. She's got a serious brain injury, but those can be remedied. You can work on those, and she's doing what she needs to do on those. But one of the issues he raised as a concern was her reluctance because of mental health conditions to really do everything she needed to do to address her situation. And so the mental health component was a part, along with the physical therapy, that part. And then her psychologist also raised the third concern, which was her situational issues. The divorce was traumatic for her. She was not going to have primary custody of her daughter, who was remaining in Minnesota with her father. She also was having to readjust moving back to Mumbai, integrating with her family, getting all of her treatment. And so it was a multifaceted thing. And I think in some sense, the Social Security Administration picked up on that too. I strongly disagree with Mr. Sobel's characterization of what that Social Security report said. I've read it many times because he keeps making this argument. And it simply is clear that the first part of her claim from prior to 2017, when she had the brain injury that led to the current situation, they found that she was still able to work. That was totally focused on mental health. But when you get to the second phase, the mental health issue doesn't go away. It's still there. And in fact, our experts highlighted that as being a significant concern, as well as the physical organic issues. But I think what is most telling is that language and in the Social Security report, order that Judge Ayling cited in there. And I quote it in my report. It's on Exhibit 18 at page 143. And he says, and this is relating to the second part of the argument or the second injury that Mr. Sobel bifurcated. And he says, medical improvement is expected with appropriate treatment. Consequently, a continuing disability review is recommended in 12 months. I don't know how the referee administrative law judge for the Social Security could have been clearer. Many Social Security disability decisions say the person is permanently disabled and we don't have to review this again. But this case, the Social Security Administration did virtually the same thing that referee Hutchison did in the family court case. Yeah, the brain injury is serious, but there are ways to deal with that. There are other forms of employment somebody with Dr. Sidwani's education, training, and interest can do. She's not only a medical doctor, she's got a graduate degree in medical education. And I think the court should take a close look. One of the more interesting exhibits, I think, that supports what referee Hutchison found here was our exhibit 38, which was our last exhibit introduced into evidence. And it came to light during the course of the trial. And it's a newspaper article where Dr. Sidwani is interviewed, as is the physical therapist who testified. And it basically is a glowing report of how wonderful she's doing. She was doing volunteer work with the Parkinson's Institute. She was writing, she was she was meeting with people, she was doing kind of nonprofit stuff. Clearly somebody who is on the road to recovery. Now, is she gonna be an emergency room doctor? Perhaps not, but there's a lot of things a person can do with a medical degree. And I think it's important that we keep that in context. So
Mr. Deboli, can I bring you back that finding 72 that you referenced? Isn't it precisely the ending of that finding that appellant is referring to as the error, at least as terms of the ultimate conclusion, and that is to some capacity? Doesn't that tell us that the judge or the referee actually doesn't know the capacity at this point? That's precisely the uncertainty the statute refers to, such that the court should have ordered permanent maintenance. And then your client could, in 2 years or some other years, bring a motion to modify.
Yeah, I think you're, and I struggled with that language too. I read it closely and I was reading that at the same time I was reading the Myers and the Bastian decisions. And I take on that when he uses that she is able to return to work in some capacity, I think his conclusion was that she will be able to do something. We don't know what it is. And that is similar in my mind to this idea, we don't know when she'll be able to do it. But clearly it's not the case where she absolutely will not be able to do it. And he's not saying, I think he's confident that she will be able to do something, more than confident, she will be able to do something. We don't know what. So I think he was justified in reaching that decision. And it's the similar analysis that was offered in Myers and Bastian. It builds on the Dobrin case on these situations where we know the person's going to be able to do something. They may not be able to do what they were initially trained for, what they previously did, but they can contribute to their support. I think that was clearly established by this record. Remember, referee Hutchison witnessed Dr. Sidwani in the courtroom for 3 days of trial, watched her go up and down from the witness stand, saw what was going on. She traveled back from India several weeks before the trial started, lived by herself in a hotel, got herself to Dr. Gratzer's for the evaluation. Lots of indicators in this case that things are not as dire as Mr. Sobel would have you believe. And so again, if we look at the deference that needs to be given to the court, I think the findings are justified. And I also think the burden of proof makes some sense in this case, because again, let's be clear on what the referee did. He did not deny her request for permanent maintenance. He reserved it. The reservation was critical in Myers and in Bastion. Without the reservation, those trial courts may have been overturned. In fact, that was one of the parts where this court reversed the trial court in Bastion, where there was no reservation, just a temporary award. And I think it makes a lot of sense to put that burden on Ms. Sidwani. You know, the Dobrin case that Mr. Sobel cited references that we want people who are getting temporary awards of maintenance to have some incentive to keep working on improving their situation. A burden of proof does that for her. It does not impose on her a modification standard, which would be very burdensome. That's the standard that Mr. Sobel wants on my client. And so I think what the court did is a good compromise, given the situation with the record and everybody being impressed by her improvement, but nobody knowing where this will go. But at the same time, wanting her to have an incentive to keep doing what she's doing, including addressing her mental health issues, which are critically important.
But how do you get around the statute that says if there's an uncertainty as to her ability or her health condition, whether it allow her to work, that the court shall order permanent?
Well, again, I think
that around that, because everything you said, and as I read the findings here from 72 on to 75, it screams out uncertainty. I mean, because no one really knows, and we haven't, and there's no finding by this court that she will improve with treatment. There is no finding that I can find, and please correct me if I'm wrong here. So why wouldn't this be the actual situation that the statute was addressing?
Well, again, Your Honor, I think that looking at, if you read Myers and read Bastion, that was the exact issue that was before those two courts.
Except the appellant has argued that Myers, it wasn't a matter of if she was.
I think Judge Hooten, I think, is cutting in and out a little bit, at least from my point of view. But
yes,
hopefully if we wait just a little bit, perhaps she will come back into a strong connection. Let's just wait while she's in the middle of her question. And of course, we'll extend the time as necessary to Judge Hooten. Can you hear me well right now? Judge Hooten? We'll just wait a minute or if we need to. Judge Hooten, can you hear me right now?
Yes.
So we lost you for 10 or 20 seconds. I think you were in the middle of a question following up, I think, on Mr. Diebele's statement about Myers and Basting. If you could, so it, maybe if Judge Hooten, if you remember your question, could you repeat it for us?
Judge Hooten, I think I got the gist of your question. You were wanting me to distinguish Bastion and Myers, which Mr. Sobel did. Was that kind of where you were going? How are they the same as the situation we have here? Yeah, and I think if you look at those cases, it was the same thing. One of them, I forget which, I think it might have been the Bastion one, was more of a mental health concern rather than a physical concern. But it was the same sort of thing. The trial court had enough evidence before it to be confident that this spousal maintenance recipient.
Excuse me, Mr. Diebele, can you wait just a minute? Judge Hooten, do you, I mean, you may have missed some of that. Would you like Mr. Diebele to repeat his answer to your question?
Yeah, you know, I would, and I would ask that he be allowed more time because I obviously, because of my issues here. And what I'm gonna
agree.
Do is stop my video. So if you don't mind.
Okay, yeah, we'll trust that you're still there on audio. Okay, so I think we're at the point where the question has been asked of Mr. Diebele, and you can proceed to answer it fully, Mr. Diebele. Thank you.
As I was saying, Judge Hooten, I think those two cases are similar factually in the sense that, again, they were different kinds of disabilities, I believe. But I think there was enough in the record to indicate that, you know, the recipient of maintenance had the ability to do something in terms of training or get employment that would contribute to their support. And in both of those cases, they were temporary awards with a reservation with the burden on that recipient. And I think those are exceptions. I don't think the record is as clear as Mr. Sobel would have everybody believe that this, that Dr. Sidwani was absolutely disabled. You know, I think the indicators were that she was making progress. She had a background that would allow her to do a lot of different things. And I think, again, the two-year window that he put in place is appropriate. Deal with mental health issues, deal with physical issues, deal with her situational things, and come back and see where we are. You know, it really comes down to who is it fair to impose the burden of proof on? And I think this is a very workable, reasonable, justified compromise with what he did here by saying, we're not going to preclude her from asking for permanent maintenance, but remember, she has the burden of proof. And look at this record. You know, that was another thing that we didn't, you know, that needs to be mentioned, I think, is she never called her own neurologist to testify. She never hired a vocational evaluator. She had her physical therapist and her psychologist testify. And we did cross-examination. We raised questions. The referee sat and heard that testimony and still did not come back saying, this is a case that absolutely mandates permanent maintenance. So I think that the referee's decision is within his discretion. It should be affirmed. And I don't think it runs afoul of the statute mandating permanency when there's doubt as to whether the person will ever be able to contribute to their support. So I'll just briefly, if I could just touch on the last two issues, I can do those in a minute or two, and hopefully we won't go too far here. That the issue of the amount of maintenance is a bizarre one, in my opinion, because what the referee did was he used Dr. Sidwani's own expert that she retained to opine about her budget and what her expenses were. He took that budget and he reduced it by about $220, applied that to what her need was, and then he subtracted the Social Security income and said, here's the amount of maintenance she needs. It was never clear to any of us in the course of the trial that she had her own budget that she submitted as well. How that budget was to interact with her expert's budget, I don't know, but I had two experts testify. The court made a determination that I'm going to go with this expert that was called by Dr. Sidwani. That is not an abuse of discretion. And those numbers are justified and should not be overturned. And similarly with the award of attorney's fees. There was plenty of basis for my client to challenge the amount and duration of this spousal maintenance. We had a 3-day trial. We're sitting here today at the Court of Appeals arguing over what the situation is. How it could not be a clearer case where my client was justified in raising these concerns, I can't imagine. I pointed out some of the bad faith actions taken by Dr. Sidwani that drove up some of the litigation costs. The court even alluded to it. If he were going to award fees to Mr. Sobel, some of Mr. Sobel's fees were unjustified. And as for need, you know, she got over $1 million property settlement. Both the marital homestead and the rental property were sold shortly after the divorce. She got liquid assets there. She's got gold jewelry, and she's had a whole history of family support for decades while these parties were married. Regular, ongoing family support. Mr. Sobel faulted us for digging into what was going on with the family businesses and financial support, but it was clearly a source of financial support during this marriage.
Could you please support it? I think it's time to sum up, Mr. Deebly.
Yes, I understand. I'm done, Your Honor.
Judge Hooten, any further questions for Mr. Deebly?
No, thank you.
All right. Very good. Thank you, Mr. Deebly. Mr. Sobel, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
First, I want to talk about the issue of the record. Mr. Deebly spent a few minutes talking about what Dr. Desai said. Dr. Desai never testified. I never had the chance to cross-examine him. I do not believe Rule 110 says that you can just introduce affidavit testimony that was submitted a year earlier as a testimony at trial and that the trial court can consider that. We cited to several cases where I think this court has made clear, Graham versus Davis and Thiel versus Stitch, that if affidavits and depositions, if they're not introduced as separate exhibits at trial, are not part of the record and can't be considered. It's a fundamental issue of due process. How can I respond to an affidavit when the witness isn't present for me to cross-examine? It's not part of the record. I think it should have been excluded. Your Honor, in terms of the issue of suggesting that we cherry picked, we did not cherry pick. The record is absolute. And the problem is, again, my perception is that this is a respondent who's a medical doctor that doesn't want to accept the diagnosis of his wife. Lots of discussion on Mr. Deebly's argument about her being able to recover and get another job. There was not one, there was no testimony that even if she could get a job, she'd be self-supporting. And that's the key issue. Could she be self-supporting? The only testimony that was proffered was Ms. Bazaj, who said, and Mr. Kinger, who testified that if she got a job in the future, it would be a low-level job. So again, on this record, she was never going to find a job that was going to make her fully self-supporting. It doesn't matter how smart she was before her brain injury. She had a brain injury that has permanently affected her cognition. It has permanently affected her mobility. And at the time of trial, there was a question as to her ability to become fully self-supporting because the testimony indicated at most she could hold a low-level job. We addressed that article. Again, this is kind of illustrative of how Dr. Israni jumps on things and reaches conclusions that aren't supported by the record. There was a newspaper article in Mumbai that misreported that she was practicing medicine. And we had ample testimony that the reporter made an error the paper was in the process of correcting it. She wasn't practicing medicine. She went to a hospital and sat in as a volunteer and watched a procedure. And suddenly Dr. Israni has turned that into, oh, look, there's an exhibit that shows she's able to work. If that's his proof, I think, again, that shows that the court erred in finding that there was.
Mr. Sobel, could I get you back to the issue of reservation a little bit? Sure. And perhaps I'm just struggling a little bit with the distinction of that. I'm assuming one option the judge could have had is simply issue an order and not a final judgment explaining why the judge believed there was insufficient evidence of whether there's, in other words, to get to the whether there's a certainty or not, such that I'm going to continue the hearing and here's the issues that I think the parties need to expand on. So nothing changes in terms of the burden. How is that different from simply reserving it to do much the same thing?
Because again, I think that this is the theory of the respondent that somehow you can at some future date shift the burden of proof. And that's what this respondent is asking this court to do, to make new law, to change how 518.552 places the burden of proof on litigants. When there's an award of permanent maintenance, the person that wants to change it in the future has the burden of proof. When you reserve it like the respondent wants to do, in essence, the appellant has to come back in 2 years and retry her case and prove once again she's totally disabled. I don't think that 518.552 subdivision 3 provides for that. It provides for finality. You have a trial. You present evidence. You presented evidence. The evidence was, and the court accepted, she was totally disabled at the time of the hearing. There was no evidence that in the future she was going to recover to a sufficient extent that she could become gainfully employed and become fully self-supporting. Best she could do, again, this is their record, low-level job. No evidence that she could support herself in a low-level.
Mr. Sobel, and Mr. Deebly raises in his respondent's brief that it's going to be logistically really difficult for the respondent to get the evidence for a modification because of the circumstances of her living in India. Is this something that, I mean, it was an abuse of discretion for the judge to take this into consideration, how difficult it'd be?
I'm not sure how difficult it would be. He's got family in Mumbai. He's got friends in Mumbai. If she's working, it's not going to be, she's not, it's just, how is it any different than if she's living in the Twin Cities and she gets a job? He's going to have to find out she got a job. He's going to have to make a motion or he's going to take her deposition at some point in the future. He can take her deposition. We're talking by Zoom right now. We don't have to go to Mumbai or she doesn't have to come here to take her deposition. They can notice her deposition in 2 years, say, what are you doing? Why are you working? They can depose or they can subpoena her health providers in Mumbai, get her records, see if there's been any change, see if she's recovered anymore. They can check with Social Security to see if there's been a follow-up hearing. I don't buy that just because she's in Mumbai, he's precluded from looking in the future as to whether or not there's a basis for him to modify.
Can I ask one more question?
Sure.
Yes, you may.
Thank you, Judge.
Yes, you may.
What about obtaining an adverse medical examination if he wants to do that?
He not only could he do that, he did that. Dr. Desai was an adverse exam that they commissioned in Mumbai during the discovery phase of this trial. That's where he came from. They wanted an adverse cognitive evaluation, and Dr. Desai did it for them. He was their expert.
It appears there are no further questions. Thank you, Mr. Sobel. Thank you to both attorneys. The case is deemed submitted. The court will issue its opinion in writing within 90 days.